All right. Welcome back, everybody, to the Quill and Query podcast. This is episode 14, episode 2 of season 2. My name is Brandon Hall. As always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host here, Ash. Ash, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. It's a Tuesday, you know, the usual Tuesday vibe. How are you?
Same. I feel that. Been a busy week for me, for sure. So we're going to just try to ride it to the weekend and hope next week is a little easier.
Fingers crossed.
Usually isn't, but
it just, you know, we'll take it as it comes.
For sure. Well, we have some fun topics to go over today. We're going to talk a little bit about book age ratings, writing fan fiction, and some more marketing strategies. We touched on book trailers last week, and I found a few other ones that I wanted to go over. But before we get into all of that, as always, we like to do our reading check-in. Looks like you got a new book this week, so what are you reading this week?
I do. So this is for book club. It is The Five Wounds by Kristen Valdez Quaid, and it's pretty good so far. It is, again, the one thing I like, I say this every time, one thing I like about book club is that it forces me to read books I would never normally pick up, but so far the writing is great and the story is really interesting, so I'm gonna keep on chugging. I have dropped every other book, unfortunately. I need to get back into the creative groove. But yeah, what are you reading?
I'm still working through Dante's Inferno, slowly but surely. It's a fun time though. I like kind of using these classics as like a palate cleanser occasionally from my usual fantasy reads and whatnot. So it's nice to go back to something different once in a while here. But yeah, it's good. I'm enjoying it. And after I'm done with this, I'm probably going to go back to my usual cycle of The Last Argument of Kings and then the Dragon Age book I was reading to catch up on the game lore before I dive into the next one.
Heck yeah. Where are we at in the Inferno? Have we gotten into it yet, or are you still in the
still upper? Still kind of in the upper. I'm trying to pace it like to where I am in the game. So in in the game, I think I just got to Greed, and so I'm right around there.
Fun.
But I'm trying to reserve some thoughts until I get like a little further, just because it's still kind of early. I still have several circles of hell to go through. So.
Don't we all?
in many manners of speaking. But yeah, that's what we're reading. So I'm just going to repeat some podcast updates for those of you who may have missed them in a previous episode. But if you have not followed us yet on our new socials, we have an Instagram, which is at Quill and Query Podcast. TikTok, also at Quill and Query Podcast. We're going to be posting some clips from the podcast on TikTok soon. And I'm working on getting the episodes up on YouTube. I have the first episode drafted as an upload, just making sure some of like the metadata and the tags and everything look good, and we'll get that up, and then I'll try to be more consistent about getting those up around Friday when I upload the RSS episodes and things like that. And we have a new format for those of you who watch us on TikTok Live. We're streaming from Riverside. We said that last episode, but just a new platform that's going to give us more control over things like audio and video quality, and allow us to put out a lot more content on social media. So I promise I won't repeat those on the next episode. I just wanted to get them out one more time for those of you who might have missed them. And now you don't have to hear me repeat the same spiel every episode.
I like it.
All right. That was that took some breath. Yeah. That's another reason I can't repeat it every time, just because it takes too much out of me.
I feel that.
But yeah, okay, let's move right into our topics. I guess I had the brilliant idea of starting with probably the most controversial one this week, but we're just going to go for it. Book age ratings. So we've talked a little bit about content warnings and things like target audiences in the past. And I think you and I kind of were on the same page where we're okay with, or we more prefer the, I guess, the generalized, the more broader content warnings that you might see for like a film or a video game, as opposed to like a shopping list of very specific possible triggers. But recently, I think you were a part of the discussion as well there on Book Talk. There was some kind of gauging of interest of a age rating system similar to movies, TV, video games, for books. And it's not the first time an idea for this has come up. And naturally, there were a lot of differing opinions on many sides of the arguments for and against it. So I was kind of curious. I saw some of your, you know, your comments in the Discord, and I'm sure you saw some of mine, but for those of, for people who haven't been in the Discord and who are just listening to us, what are your overall thoughts on a rating system like this for books? Like, are you for it? Are you against it? Are you somewhere in the middle? And then why or why?
Yeah. So I really like the concept of a rating system, and the Discord that we are in has been really interesting to see where everyone's mind is at and how their brains work in regards to the rating system. I think the reason that I feel like there are a few reasons as to why there is no rating system currently for books, because at least in genres with our books, we have like YA, right? And when you think of YA, you kind of think of, you know, more like PG to PG-13. And then you have middle grade, which is more G. So I feel like sometimes those like genres tend to speak for themselves. But as we've become a much more accessible kind of culture and community, and more people are writing their own books and getting themselves published, I find the maybe the casual use of rating systems is really helpful. Do I think it needs to be like across the board? I feel like that would be a little bit too challenging, because just like movies, there's kind of like a variety. But anyway, it's a very complicated issue. I really like them. I've been enjoying the discussions about them. They can be finicky because a lot of it is up to the author at this point. You know, like what do you consider? Like what I consider YA can, I mean, I've read YA that's pretty rough in terms of its content. Important to write though, because a lot of YA readers are going through very rough stuff in their life. So it can be almost a little too fluid of a rating system, but I like the concept and I like what everyone's trying to do in the Discord about it. I'm probably someone that will have the trigger warning / any self, you know, once we get everything finalized, have my own rating if I choose to self-publish, because I find it to be pretty important, I think. What about you? I'm you feel the same way, I know, but what's your take on it?
Yeah, so I was actually doing some research just to kind of educate myself a little more on the topic, because when the idea of a rating system was brought up, I was like, certainly traditional publishing has probably tried to do something like this before or thought about it and put, you know, money into the research of whether this would be a good idea or not. And one of the most commonly reiterated reasons against a rating system, like why traditional publishing hasn't really enforced one or created one that's standard for people to follow, is because with books specifically, usually the maturity of the content scales with the reading level. And so, and as I was thinking about that, you know, I was thinking about like the adult books that I read, like A Game of Thrones or the First Law trilogy. And I was thinking about how very inaccessible, I suppose, they would be to someone who's not on like an adult reading level. And so I think with books, you do get some more kind of natural barriers to entry in that regard. Like it would be very hard for someone who's like 10 or 11, I think, to pick up a Game of Thrones, at least knowing myself when I was that age. And so there's a little less to worry about in them being exposed to potentially harmful content. And also, I think traditional publishers do a much better job of, and I don't mean any shade to indie authors, they just have more resources, more research and things at their disposal. But as far as like making sure the book ends up in the right hands of their target audience, I think from what I could see, it just seems to be less and less of an issue for traditional publishing. Now, granted, there are like, you know, recent, you know, book banning sprees and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think those are all focused on kind of broader issues that don't really have, that wouldn't really be fixed by our age rating system, in my opinion, maybe to some extent. But some of those things are just like more political than, you know, anything that could be fixed by, like I said, by an age rating system. Even if you slap an adult rating onto something, I don't think it's going to fix the problem 100%. I do think, and I'm going on a bit of a long-winded rant here, but
that's okay. Go for it.
I do think that the concept and the idea is good, and it comes from a good place. I just think there are a lot of things that need to be considered when you do something like this, especially something that's like self-applied, right? So there's a lot of trust that has to go into the author rating something correctly, and then there's so many different moving pieces to something like this. But yeah. Overall, I'm not opposed to it at all. I just think it's important to know why it doesn't exist now. But yeah,
I feel like that's a really good point. No, I think that's a great point. I think we tend to jump into the yes or the no. Mm-hmm. Are we for or against without, you know, understanding the context of, I do feel like, you know, considering how long book publishing has been around, that this kind of system would have already been implemented if it was, you know, a viable and consistent across the board. Right. You know, I feel like with movies, with the movie rating system, it is in of itself also kind of a political weird like system where the people that are asked to do this are, it's pretty murky. It gets strange, and there's like a lot of connections that you have to do. And, you know, if you're watching Deadpool, you're like, I get why this is rated R, you know,
yeah.
Versus like a Disney movie. And you're like, oh, yeah, I get that it's G, even though every now and then they can like throw a curse word in there. So it's a lot less straightforward. And I think, you know, you're right. Like the grade levels and the age ranges kind of speak for themselves. I think it is ultimately up to, you know, if you're a young child, hopefully a parent or a guardian of some sort, whether it be a teacher or a sibling or something, is being like, yeah, you shouldn't be reading Game of Thrones in middle school. Unless you're someone, not to toot my own horn, but like I was reading stuff I shouldn't have been reading in middle school because my parents were like, oh, she's like an avid reader and she's reading at a college level. And so why would we say, you know, they just didn't.
Yeah.
They were like, yeah, go for it. I mean, hey, it's how you get exposed to stuff. But mine are very different in that regard. That was kind of a unique early 2000s situation that we're not in right now.
Right.
I think people conflate the book banning a little too much with like, do we need to be more clear with what's in a book? And I think in the indie and self-publishing space, most books that are getting published recently, at least in the context of what we talk about a lot, is based off of like TikTok, a more adult leaning content. So it's a little easier to just be like, okay, this is a monster romance and that's all you need to know, right? Like that's just, you know, or this is a cozy fantasy. Like we already put words attached to certain things, like, you know, the spice levels. Is it spicy? Is it not spicy? Smutty. Like we have all these terminologies now that kind of help the self-publishers pigeonhole their book where it needs to go. I do think it is maybe something we should talk about in the future, though, once we kind of get more into the Discord and see what comes up with these book bans, and not to get political at all, but like the next election cycle, like what does that mean for a book publishing world and how the book banning kind of system coincides. So yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, totally agree. I think there's just so many moving pieces that need to be in consideration. And I think when it comes to like my own publishing, if I publish something and it ends up in the wrong hands, I would like, I wouldn't be like, obviously I wouldn't be happy about that, but I would consider that more of a marketing failure on my part, I think, to some extent. I would look at the cover first, probably more than anything. I'd be like, does this cover say, like I said, this is adult fantasy, but does this cover look appealing to someone who might be like 12 or 13? So I think there's like, then there's things like that too. Like you can communicate to your audience in so many different ways, from the cover to the blurb to your social media material, but also you're right. And like, not everyone's going to see all of that all the time. So
yeah,
there
someone
are
might just like click on it and be like, oh, that looks cool. And then realize, oh, maybe not. I mean, I've read a couple arcs this year where the covers are very like quaint and like could absolutely be in a high school library, but it's like, should they be reading it? I mean, I think so, because it's like not too bad at all, but you know, it's like, you know, this is like supposed to be for adults. And so yeah, maybe that'll be a good topic for us to discuss, like how book covers can relay information, because it is it's interesting. Sometimes you're like, this looks YA, and then it's like, oh, that way.
Yeah. I think that is that's a good idea for a future topic for sure. All right. Well, on the topic of marketing, we're not going to talk about mm-hmm. covers right now, but we have some other marketing tropes that are quite prevalent on both Instagram and TikTok. I see a lot of it, especially in the indie space. So I'm trying to think of how to put this into words. It's when someone's marketing their book, they'll usually pitch it in these scenarios as existing popular thing meets mm-hmm. existing popular thing. And a lot of times I find this can almost be oversaturated in their marketing, to where finding out just an actual like blurb or what the book is actually about can sometimes be quite difficult. But yeah, I just wanted to get your thoughts, because I was talking to a few other friends who read about this type of marketing.
Yeah.
Where it's like constantly relying on referencing existing pop culture. And so does that marketing appeal to you at all? Like, does it ever get your attention? And what are your thoughts on doing that, like, as a writer? And if you want specific examples of ones I've seen, I can give them, because there's some wacky ones. Yeah. So one I saw, so I will say you can do it right. Like, you can do it well to where I usually can grasp what you're saying.
Yeah.
But there are some that I see where I feel like it poses more questions than answers, and not necessarily in a good way. Like, one I saw was Game of Thrones / X-Men / The Hunger Games. And so that it made like the question mark go off. Like, I was like, yeah, okay, but what does that mean? Like, are there even if you just said like Game of Thrones meets X-Men, are you trying to tell me like superheroes in a medieval world? Or are you trying to say a superhero organization like the X-Men with the politics of Game of Thrones? Like, I'm not getting the message that you're trying to send here. I think something else might have been a little more effective, but sometimes they just bother me slightly, where I'm like, I don't know what you're trying to say. Can you please just tell me what it's about?
I completely agree with you. I think it can be done right. I've mm-hmm. seen examples of it. I think Jordan, I'm blanking on her username, but Jordan does it really well. She's like, The Witcher meets something else, and I can't remember. And it was like it was similar enough. Like, it was like another fantasy franchise that it was like, it worked. And I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. I'm like into that. So I think if you like, in my opinion, it can't be too different, right?
Right.
If you want to say something like the politics of G.R. Martin meets the school experience of Harry Potter, right? Like, I feel like you can do that, but you have to give more context. You can't just be like Game of Thrones meets X-Men, and you're like, is it the violence and the politics of Game of Thrones? Is it the, like, the mythical stuff of Game of Thrones versus the mutant aspect of X-Men? So they either have to be just similar enough that you're like, I get it, or you need to expound upon them. Because if you're just like throwing in things just to get people's attention, and most of the time, to be honest, most of the time they don't even actually have any connection to any of those things.
Right.
You end up being like, where is the Game of Thrones? Where is the X-Men? I don't understand. You know, Fourth Wing got, and I'm probably saying this wrong and someone's going to come for me, but I think it was like Hunger Games meets Sarah J. Maas.
Mm-hmm.
And that sold me, because I was like, oh, very similar kind of concepts, like, the violence of the Hunger Games with like the being together in one place and then the dragons, like, okay, I can get it behind. Like, but then I like read it and I was like, this is nothing like either of them. So I think it can go so bad so quickly. I don't know if I will use them or like that kind of trick in my own marketing. I did do something recently where I took a psychometrics test as if I were like each one of my characters to see what percentage they matched other fantasy universes. So my male main character got like 97% Brienne of Tarth, like 91% Geralt of Rivia, which is cool because then you're like, okay, it gives some people some context of what their character might be like. Right. But I'm not calling my novel like a mashup of this and like Buffy the Vampire Slayer or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think it can be a really slippery slope. If you set that expectation that it's going to be like two or three of these beloved universes of which fans are very strongly fans, I think you can actually unintentionally hurt your marketing strategy if it doesn't deliver. So my advice to authors would just be like, tread carefully there. Like, unless you are taking heavy inspiration, which is totally okay if you do, right? If you read Fourth Wing and you're like, I can write a better Fourth Wing, you can use that as your marketing strategy. But, you know, yeah, Game of Thrones and X-Men and Star Trek, that's crazy.
Yeah. It's... like you said, you can do it well to where like the message is clear, but right. when you're grasping at like two totally different pieces of media, I feel like it's not really helping you. I feel like you're just trying to grab fans of those at that point. Yes. And I totally agree with what you said about setting the expectation then that you're going to be like as good as those are, and not saying you're not, but like I feel like you are doing yourself a disservice.
Yeah.
By setting that expectation so high so early on, mm-hmm. like before they've even picked the book up.
That's a lot of pressure. I feel like that's right. A crap ton of pressure to even put on yourself. You know, you're kind of like, oh, I mean, confidence is great. If you're like, mine is the next big this, that, and the other, yeah, own it. But I feel like it's one wrong misstep. And then suddenly people are like, you sold me on this. And it was nothing like that.
Right. Oh, there. I had a train of thought from one of the other things you said, and I'm trying to pick it up. No, all right, we're just gonna move on. If it comes back to me, I'll go back to it.
There you go. Just be like, oh, I remember. Cool.
Yeah.
Well,
okay. Actually, I remember what it was now.
Oh, nice.
No, I was gonna say it sometimes, and no offense to anybody who does it, but sometimes it also does feel like a little lazy in as far as like your marketing goes. To me anyway, like if it's constantly that, like if you do it once in a while, I think it's fine. But if everything I'm seeing about your book is like, it's this meets this, I'm personally not a fan of that. I'm not like drawn in by that. I like to know, like, give me a blurb, give me a line from yes. the book, you can tell me what your inspirations are, but if you're constantly selling me that this is this meets this, it yeah. just feels like kind of lazy marketing to me, in my opinion. Just, but again, no shade to you if you're doing that. I just encourage you to try other methods of trying to sell your story, because I don't think that's yeah. the best one.
I think it should be a component if it's something that really strikes true to you and the crux and holistic aesthetic of your novel. But I think uses of this meets this in marketing helps when it's coming from reviews. I've yes. seen reviews, and I have done it before, where I'm like, this reminds me of like the Brothers Grimm meets this or something like that. And when I'm seeing it from somebody else, or I am writing it myself and like using that as a way to get other readers to understand the aesthetic or the vibe of the novel, then that's more helpful, because then that's not me, the author, portraying my work as some of the greats, but it's
yeah.
genuine. Hey, this is what it feels like. And it feels more authentic that way. So, you know, it's always a plus when a reviewer does that, but you can't ask reviewers to be like, can you say, I mean, it's this. So it's hard. It's hard. And I don't envy anyone having to market their own stuff, which is what we're going to have to do with the anthology. You know, it's really challenging, even just with this podcast.
Marketing yeah, for sure.
is hard. So props to anyone, even if you use those kind of tools. I just think if you're thinking about it, be careful.
Yeah, I think as with anything, when it comes to writing, if I had to boil it down to like a very simple tip, it would just be intentional about
yes
the things you're comparing it to. Like, don't just throw all your inspirations in there.
Yeah, right.
All right, well, that's our...
big sigh, Brandon, big sigh.
It's a big sigh kind of day today.
I totally understand. Hopefully our listeners are also big sighs on Tuesdays, so they get
yeah. it. All right, well, something that's been on my mind for a while... this is mostly, I think it's more prevalent in the film and video game industry for sure, but it definitely pokes in its head in into the book industry once in a while too, is the disparity between revisiting existing franchises that have already ended versus creating new things. I think that's probably one of the biggest like weaknesses of the current state of the film industry right now, is it feels like everything or 90% of movies coming out is it's a reboot, it's a sequel to something that should have and that was ended long ago. And games are doing the same thing, even probably even worse, arguably, because games do remasters. So they re-release old games with, now granted, they do have new tech behind it. So sometimes it can be interesting to see like, oh, this game that came out 20 years ago, we couldn't quite nail the vision. We didn't have the tech, but now we do. So, you know, once in a while, it'll work out. But sometimes it definitely feels just like a money grab. But I wanted to get your thoughts on this as a creator of stories. What are your thoughts as like, firstly, as a consumer of these stories? How do you feel about revisiting something that, you know, you think was wrapped up pretty well? Do you kind of like just sigh like me when you see a trailer for something and it's Star Wars Episode 11, like, or something along those lines?
This is one of those things that I will just kind of go on forever and rant about, so I will not do that here. But I am genuinely so fatigued, speaking of Tired Tuesdays, I'm just very tired of that. Disney, the worst proponent of this, I think, you know, the live action everything reboots of it all. It's just like, I've seen this story. What are you going to do aside from the visuals, impressive as they are? I'm personally really tired of CGI. Like, really can't stand it at this juncture. I think what we're seeing is a lack of genuine creativity. And it sucks because when new stuff does come up, it tends to get pigeonholed into these, just like we were talking about, like this meets that, you know, and it just can't stand new on its own. And, you know, take Long Legs, for example. I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard mixed reviews because the marketing was like, this is a horror movie, and people are like, it was really disturbing and unnerving, but it wasn't necessarily like a horror movie based on that definition. So it's hard. It's a hard in the streaming world to come up with creative stuff that doesn't already exist. So I can't imagine being a showrunner or like having to create content. But yeah, I'm just genuinely very tired of it. I kind of feel that way about certain authors too. I know I always bring her up every episode, but Sarah J. Maas is one of them. The concept of having a multiverse where characters overlap potentially is cool in theory. But if you're using that as a way to just sell more books, which I think is kind of how it comes across in most instances, it loses its potency and its power. So yeah, I'm very much over it. I think, you know, shows like Fallout are fun because it kind of creates its own new material with a lot of context. And The Dark Crystal did that too with its TV show a few years ago. It didn't try to rehash stuff, but it did include, you know, the lore. With movies like Wicked coming out and people being like, I want a reboot of this, I just don't understand. I just can't. I'm tired of the same formula. You know, I want something new. So, yeah, I'm just not a fan. With the recent announcement of Robert Downey Jr. as Dr. Doom, I was like, what are we doing here? Like, what? I don't get it. I'm going to stop it there because I will just keep going on and on about it. It's just so frustrating.
Yeah, the casting announcement definitely has the smell of like desperation and reaching for, you know, trying to sell you on nostalgia. So I think it has the potential to be good, but it also has the potential to just be, you know, a blatant cash grab and the last effort to save the MCU. I like that you brought up Fallout, though. That is one of my favorite adaptations because it respects the source material. It doesn't, you know, try to rewrite it. It stays within the confines created by the video games and whatnot. But it also tells a new story. So even if you played the games, you still have new content. Like, you don't know what's going to happen in the show. And I think that's like, that is my favorite kind of adaptation, at least for when you're adapting video games. We see so many video game shows now, like on Netflix and Amazon, and a lot of them are just kind of rewriting the story from the game, usually kind of worse. Halo.
I got 20 minutes into it and I was like, no, there is no way you're going to get me to watch this.
As a Halo fan since I was 5 years old, that was probably that I have a lot to say on the Halo show that I'm not going to say here, but let's just say I did not watch season two, and I was not terribly upset when it was canceled. But
yeah. So I think going off of like the superhero stuff, which is, you know, I think there are equitable overlaps in the book world as well. But, you know, when you think of The Boys, the TV show, or Joker, and then the second Joker that's coming out, these are all twists on a theme, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what happened if the world existed where superheroes were actually awful and run by a corporation? Cool. That's such a great. The Watchmen, I think we're going to watch that tonight. Watchmen, a nice. Cool twist on that theme too, right? Like, I don't know. I just feel like it is, you can do it. And even if people get worried in the book world, like, oh, I'm worried my book is going to be too much like this book or too much like that book or this series or this movie. But that's okay, because people enjoy those themes. They enjoy similar characters. They like, you know, you can include all of that while still having your own unique twist on it. You don't need to rely on a franchise to make it work. So, yeah, I need a little more creative. I mean, I'm in my book, it's the same way. I take a lot of, you know, references from a bunch of other stuff, like everyone does. But it's also not a story that's been written by me before. So that's where it changes and makes a difference. So, yeah, you don't need to rely on old school stuff, in my opinion.
Yeah, for sure. So we talked about from like the consumer perspective. Now, how about and this is easy to say when no one's offering us like millions of dollars to revisit something. So I want to preface it by saying that my answer might change, you know, if you came with a bag, but
I see where your loyalties lie there, Brandon.
Well, you know, if the number's high enough, okay. Well,
yeah.
But just say it's not canon or something like that. It's
sure.
I'm just joking, but no, that is a real consideration. Like, it's easy to say, no, I'll like, this is over, I'm not gonna touch it and whatnot.
Yes.
And then, but then the, you know, the film studio comes to you and they're like, but what if we pay you $100 million for
right.
the licensing?
Okay, maybe.
Like, I was reading RDJ's contract for Marvel, and he's getting paid $80 million for, I don't remember if it's for both or just for one film, but it's insane. And I'm like, I mean, I can't even be mad at someone for not turning that kind of money down at that point.
Yeah.
It's like,
it's just so interesting. Sidebar, people like are like, he just did Oppenheimer. Like, how do you go from Oppenheimer to then going back to the MCU being like, yeah, I'll be Dr. Doom? Like, I don't get it. But no, you're exactly right. So I actually don't know if a lot of people know this, but a few like bigger authors end up writing for like Disney and doing the like little novellas in the new book series that Disney's been putting out. Mm-hmm. There's like one on Maleficent. There's one on like a bunch of the evil characters in the Disney universe. I think Maggie Stiefvater wrote one. Anyway, a few authors I follow who do their own work also get asked to write these kind of like canon-esque novels about already occurring Disney characters. And I think that's interesting because it's like, one, yeah, you're getting your bag. But two, you are being asked to create something unique based off of your own writing style, of course, within these parameters. And I'm sure it's like that South Park episode where like they're writing a what is it? The boys put on, they make a band and then they get asked to do a biopic. And China is sponsoring it. But then the guy from China is like standing behind him, like, cross that out. So I'm sure it's the same thing when you work for a franchise,
right. Regardless,
like you have all these parameters. But yeah, I think, you know, as a yeah, as a writer, I don't think I could say no if that were the case.
Yeah.
But, you know, it'd be really challenging. It'd be really hard. It'd be like a moral thing. Like, do I say no to the money? No, obviously.
I think it depends on, like, how much money do I already have at that point? You know, like, do I need the $80 million or do I already have $500 million? Because at that point, it might be easier, but no, I appreciate the honesty because I know a lot of people are like, no, I would never. And I'm like, you really have never been offered that kind of money before because that's.
I got debt to pay. Right. I've got, you know, you have all these like dreams and aspirations too. It's like, of course I would absolutely probably say yes. With the caveat of like, I think the difference is like, I want to be involved, right?
Yeah,
so
right.
It's like, when, like Leigh Bardugo wanted to be heavily involved in the Shadow and Bone series so that when decisions got made, she was included in that conversation, knowing and understanding that not everything could be done the way she wanted it to because it's a show. But I think her voice was like super essential. So I think that would be my, like, if my stuff is supposed to be turned into a franchise or whatever, or I got asked to sell whatever, and money with like a big check was involved, it's like, yeah, but this, you spent a long time, I've spent years on this, you know?
Yeah.
It's like a lot of labor, a lot of hard work, and you don't want to just pass it off and then see it ruined, which tends to happen.
Yeah, well, completely agree on that part too. Like, I don't want it to sound like I'm saying money is the only factor for sure, because you know, there's important things to consider when it comes to licensing agreements and things like that. And mm-hmm. a very real possibility is that a bad adaptation of your work can ruin the book sales and stuff like that as mm-hmm. well. And like your reputation can suffer and things like that. So definitely money is not the only consideration for me there. I just didn't want to understate how important that is in the conversation, because I think a lot of people leave that part out, and that's a very big factor into why a lot of franchises that you love kind of get, you know, the beaten to death or milked until they're not providing any more money, is because there's lots of money changing hands. So I would like to say that when I am a fan of sticking with an ending. So it would, like, if I end a series, unless I've purposefully left the door open, I will say it would probably be very hard to get me to do like a follow-up series if I wasn't already planning on doing that. Just because I like endings. I don't like to see things go on forever. With the caveat of if there's enough money involved, I would consider it, but it has to be the right story. You know, there's a million different factors there.
100%.
But
I would like to be in that position. I think I can say that.
Like, we're not even, you know, we don't even need to worry about that right now.
I would love to have to worry about that. The nuance and morality of all that kind of stuff.
For sure.
Alas, we are.
Someday we just have to manifest. That's okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, it's time for our weekly work in progress check-in. Ash, I think we both want to skip this section this week. Let's just get the bad news out of the way. Ash, what is your writing update for the week?
Zilch. I have zilch. I have zero forward movement. I have been very busy. That's not an excuse, but some adjustments to be made. I was just telling my friend earlier, I was like, I don't know. I started working out again. I got a gym membership. So I'm, when I say started again, I got it yesterday. So I'm really trying to implement that. I was hungover all weekend. I life, you know, so I've got nothing done. I'm just hanging out.
That's okay. I'm kind of in the same boat, just trying to keep my, you know, my productivity routine when it comes to like work and working out and eating healthy and stuff like that in check. And I haven't had a lot of time for writing. Or reading, really, for that matter. I've mostly been helping people move stuff in my free time, like move furniture. That takes a lot out of you. So, not much done in the book world this week. But summers are always busy for me anyway, so it might just be slow progress for a little while here.
Yeah, definitely. Moving on. We're not going to talk about it anymore.
Yeah. Moving on. Let's move into our writing topics for the week. Oh, I almost lost my tab for a second there. I want to talk about writing descriptions. We touched on this a little bit it might have been last week or the week before, where we talked about our different approaches. I said I usually kind of put the descriptions in after like dialogue and things like that. And you had mentioned that it's very important to you to set the scene like very early on so that you can kind of follow your characters through the environment and things like that. So I was just, I wanted to go a little further into that. Like, how do you approach when you are writing these descriptions of whether it's the environment, the place, or the people or the things around them? Are there any rules or guidelines you give yourself when it comes to writing descriptions, or any advice you would have for anyone who might struggle with that? Because I know I struggled with descriptions for the longest time. Not so much anymore.
I would say description is one of my stronger suits. I don't think we like ever really discuss as authors the things that we do well. I feel like we're very self-deprecating and very much like, I can improve on this, I'm struggling with it, whatever. So I will say, I think I am very good at description. I think that's my strongest asset as a writer. The tip that I always use for myself is that within a page, let's say, or at least within a scene, I need to do all of the senses. So there needs to be a description of touch, taste, smell, or sound. Whether that be the sound of the character's voice, you know, they enter a room, what do they hear? Is it silence? Silence is the lack of a sound. So yeah, that counts too. Just to make sure that all of those are included in a scene, I think is important. Now, you're not going to be able to do that every scene. It kind of gets potentially formulaic, but you know, if a character is entering a new space for the first time, what does anyone do when they enter a new space? What does it look like? Okay, well, it's more than that, right? It's like, does it have a smell? Do you hear anything strange? What does it feel like? Is it cold? Is it warm? Even the most basic, I think we forget, like just simple things like it's cold in here can be helpful to make sure you don't get stuck with the white room syndrome, which is just like forgetting to write anything about anything. I think when it comes to describing or descriptions of characters, it's also important to use what you notice about people first. A lot of people like to be like, oh, I don't really like notice anyone. We all do. We have to write. It's like instinct. We don't even know we're doing it. So I feel like being present when you're writing about your characters, and if not putting yourself in your shoes, envisioning it as like a movie scene can be super helpful. But yeah, I would say like make sure you're including the five senses. If not in every scene, make sure it's like every few pages you're adding that. One that I consistently forget to add is smell, but I find smell to be super powerful in descriptions of anything because it just makes it way more physical and concrete in the description. So yeah, does that answer the question well enough?
No, it does. I like especially how you said to, you know, focus on the senses and then use like what you notice first about people. Yeah, description until recently is something that's always been kind of difficult for me to put into words, like, and I don't really know why. I could never pin down what exactly was difficult about it. It's just the whole process of describing something, and then I think there's a little bit of insecurity about, am I communicating the right vision here? Like, are readers going to pick up on what I'm trying to describe, or am I doing it all wrong?
So my two things to combat that, because I know exactly what you're discussing. One is people can't even agree on famous characters' descriptions, like Harry Potter. Like when the movies came out, there was like tons of, you know, they don't look like this. Oh, I pictured her more like that. Yada yada yada. So, regardless of what you describe, someone is not going there. It's not going to be that way at all. Their vision of it is going to be completely different. So I feel like once you get over that kind of like hurdle and just realize you just need to write for yourself and what you feel is there, it can be helpful. Tip number two for me is take a notebook with you, and when you go somewhere, whether it be a coffee shop or anywhere, actually like library or whatever, you can even look up photos on Pinterest or Google of just like a tavern, like the one that you have behind you, and set a timer for 3 minutes and describe as much as you can or however long you want it to be. Those like quick little just, I don't know, exercises can be really helpful in just, you know, moving a muscle that might be challenging for you. Also, then you have like a little notebook filled with descriptions that you can use in the future if you don't, if you're at a loss. But yeah, I think exercising that muscle is really important. Just take a notebook with you and write what you see and smell and hear.
Yeah, I agree. And I like that you mentioned, even if you can't go somewhere, you can look up the pictures, because that's actually what I did to practice a few times was, I wanted to specifically practice describing stuff that like looked like, you know, the kind of aesthetic that my book was going for. And so being able to do that with like stock photos, or even if it's an AI photo and you're just like using it to describe, like to exercise, as long as the photo makes sense. Sometimes the AI photos don't make sense. But that definitely is just, I think, something that gets better with practice. If you're someone who struggles with it like me. Mm-hmm. Just make sure you're constantly exercising that muscle. Don't let it like become lax again, because I have done that as well, where I like didn't work on it for a while and it took a little bit to get back into it. But
it's really challenging. It's not, I find dialogue, I think I said this last episode, but I find dialogue to be the most challenging for me. Mm-hmm. But description just comes just naturally, I guess. I don't know if it's because I'm always just like looking at stuff and in my head being like, oh wow, that's that, and like that's that. Yeah. And if you genuinely still try those two things and you find yourself struggling, go back to your favorite book and look at, or books period, see what your favorite authors are, how they're describing things, or circle passages and be like, what stands out to you, what makes this evocative, or what does this make super, I don't know, realistic. Yeah, all those little things. Unfortunately, we have to do homework as writers. I slack on that a lot, but we have to. We can't just like jump right in. You got to work at it. So I have so many authors talk about their first book and then their most recent book, and they're always like, God, I hate reading my first novel because it just was, I've gotten so much better. And you do. Even famous people, so yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like all creative work is kind of like that. Even in my day job, when I look back at like my early projects, I'm like, can I go fix that?
Yeah, right. Like, oh God. Even re-editing, like that's what they tell you not to edit as you write. Mm-hmm. To an extent, you know, you and I have talked about we have to do that sometimes. But
yeah,
going back and just like if you're rewriting the same chapter over and over and over again because it just doesn't feel right, you cannot do that. Like you just can't. The final chapter is going to be so much better than your first chapter, but that's what editors come in. You're going to pay an editor, or you're going to have an editor to do that for you. So gotta let go of that.
Well, before we move on to the next topic, are there any authors that you kind of look to, like as far as writing really good descriptions, or maybe they've given some tips other than the ones you've already kind of stated, that are kind of guiding you as you write descriptions, or not really anything beyond what we already touched on?
I have a few faves when it comes to description. I think Garth Nix does the magical stuff really well, by making, when he writes about magic and the physical world combining, he does it very well, so it feels real. He includes things like elements he does really well, like working with the natural world, water and wind and all that kind of stuff, so much so that it always feels very grounded in reality. He has been canceled recently, but Neil Gaiman, up until recently, was so good at that, in creating like literal like troll markets and making it feel like you could turn a left corner in your own city and like accidentally stumble across one. And the way he did that was how other characters interacted with their characters and how those characters then actually physically interacted with the world. So it's not just, oh, I walked in and it smelled like this. It was like I bumped into something and then I accidentally, you know, I nicked my hand on a sword or whatever. Like the way that the characters unintentionally and in those small moments that you wouldn't even think were important actually, you know, physically interact with things. We all trip, we sneeze, we do all these things. So yeah, I always thought he was extremely good at it, but yeah, he's on that no list now at this juncture,
unfortunately.
What about you? Do you have any people that you're like, their descriptions always make me like feel like I'm there?
I think just the, you know, the favorites I normally cite for everything. It's more just more reasons that they're kind of in my top authors. George R. R. Martin, I think, does a good job of, I know his books are long, but I think he does a good job of creating like imagery with as few words as possible. Now, when it comes to food, he's very infamous for those long descriptions of the food on the feast tables. But that's kind of a guilty pleasure of mine from A Song of Ice and Fire. Just reading the descriptions of food, I always have to go eat afterwards. But
It's like the Ghibli movies, like Miyazaki's movies. Whenever he animates food, it's just like I want that right now. It looks so good. So I totally get it.
Yeah, it's even stuff that, like, in theory would probably be disgusting, but it's like the way you describe it, it's just it sounds amazing. Then Joe Abercrombie, this may be a little bit of a weird thing to praise, but the way he describes like pain and wounds and things like that is like, it's really good. Like, I almost feel like there's this, I don't know, you haven't read First Law, correct?
I have not, no. Okay. It's on my TBR.
One of the characters is like, he's crippled and he's in constant pain. And it really comes through, like you almost feel it when you're reading from his perspective, because it just comes through the page so well, and it's so like vivid and visceral. Like I don't know how to do justice here for it, but it's just the way he describes it. It's really good. And it makes the combat sequences and the action scenes a lot more exciting, in my opinion, because then like you feel the results of that afterwards. Like you can see the damage that has been done and whatnot. So he's another one. And he also had really great advice on, I think it was an interview with Daniel Green on YouTube, where he was talking about his mom, I think, I may be getting this wrong, but she's either an editor or an English teacher, and she was helping him with one of his early drafts and descriptions. And a problem he had early on was embellishing it to the point where, like, he was using analogies or things like that that were almost, I don't know what the right word here, maybe like purple prose, like it's like too much. Where you could get the image he was going for, but it wasn't
like too lofty.
Yeah, it's like no one really describes things this way, so it's like tone it down a little bit. And so he said that was some of the best advice he's ever gotten. Like when you're describing something, especially if you're using like an analogy or comparing it to something that it looks like, read it back like aloud and visualize both and be like, does that actually look like that though, or is that like, am I embellishing a little too much here?
So that's actually exact. I have seen and watched so many reviews of self-published, like, romanticy fantasy books on TikTok, where like the biggest continuous criticism is that the descriptions don't make any sense, like the analogies or the prose, you know, like. I think there was one, The Sun and Its Moon or something like that. And she kept referring to like the sun as like a something to do with a yolk, like an egg yolk. And you're like, okay, yeah, like, sure. But then it kept getting used in like various forms. And the reviewer was like, okay, come up with a different way of describing the sun. It's not a yolk. It's hot. It's like it's an orb in the sky that's burning your skin right now. So that can be, some of the best feedback to people is just be like, sometimes less is more. Sometimes you don't have to wax poetic about the sun being in the sky. You can just be like, the sun was high and it was very hot outside.
Yeah. Sometimes that's just more effective because, you know, you don't want people to visualize like eggs up in it. I don't know. It's not
right. You're like, ew, runny eggs? Okay. So it can be hard though. It can be a dance. Sometimes you write something down, you're like, that's the best thing I've ever written. And then someone reads it and they're like, why did you say it like that?
Yeah. And I think you're gonna get those, like, no matter how much editing you do, there's gonna be some that just don't land. for some people and they do for others. So that's also important to remember as well.
Definitely.
All right. Well, moving on to things that sometimes land and sometimes don't. Epigraphs. These are, I think, probably mostly exclusive to like fantasy and sci-fi. I don't see them a lot outside of that. But I was surprised to learn recently from Brandon Sanderson that a lot of people don't read these. So if you don't know what an epigraph is, I'm sure you do. I'm just saying for the audience.
Sure.
When you read, when like you open up a fantasy book, Way of Kings, I think, has them. It's kind of like that little snippet of text that does like a little bit of lore or world building before you're actually like into the chapter. So it's not connected to it really in any way, sometimes like thematically or, you know, connected to the overall story, but it's not required reading. It's just kind of there for world building purposes. So knowing that some people actually skip these, are you one of those people?
No,
no.
I always read the epigraphs. I love an epigraph. I feel like it sets the tone. Like I get excited when I read it. And then I'm like, it's like seeing the wrapping paper on a present before you actually get to a present, right? You're like, some good ass wrapping paper, you know? Yeah, I think it's really important. Also, like, I don't know, the author took their time to write it, so I'm not going to skip it. Do I sometimes skip the acknowledgments at the end of a book? Yes, I do. However, if it's at the beginning, I'm going to read it. I find them to be, essential to the lore if you have them included. I don't currently have one for my novel. I don't see why people would skip them. I find that very silly.
Yeah. So you said you don't have them for A Filthy Hunger. Are they something you would ever envision being in A Filthy Hunger or in a future book of any kind? Like, or are you just, I don't write those?
No, I think I would. I just don't. It wasn't ever really currently a scenario. I'm too busy like building the lore and doing everything else for the rest of it. I feel like if I were to write them or include them, it would come towards the end. Like it would be included in the process at the end of the process rather than the beginning. I feel like that might be easier to write. But also, I feel like that's what the graveyard is for sometimes. You're just like, oh, this would be interesting later. But then you're like, oh, that actually be a really good epigraph. But it's not in the current outline. Knowing me, it'll probably be included at some point in time. But at this juncture, Filthy Hunger does not have an epigraph. Does yours? Does A Knight of Knives have an epigraph?
Before I answer that real quick, I just want to say hi to Megan. She says, what's up, guys? And she gave us a bunch of likes. So thank you for the likes, Megan, and glad to see you. I go back and forth on this. Sometimes I'll write one and then I'll delete it. But like as of right now, there are no epigraphs. Now there might be something that I, like you said, do at the end, but ultimately right now it's not in the cards. Like it, but I'm not opposed to it either. Like if I can think of good thematically fitting for like each chapter.
Yeah.
And I think it adds to the world and the lore and the characters and all that. Then I'll definitely do that. But also I will keep in mind that not everyone is like me and reads them. So I wouldn't expect like crucial information there, but just more stuff that fleshes out the world and kind of fits thematically with each chapter if I ever do include those. But also, if it wasn't clear, I prefer to read them unless that I will not lie, I have skipped a few that were just like way too long for me in other books. But that's not usually the case. They're usually pretty quick and pretty
usually short.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in that case I'll always read because most of the time they are like thematically connected and you know, it's not crucial, but it just adds that little bit of extra, you know, extra something to the chapter.
Yeah.
To the world and makes everything feel a little more connected.
Yeah. I think my favorites are when it's like, and I've considered this with A Filthy Hunger because the Book of Witnesses in my novel is like the holy book for one of the religions that plays a very crucial integral role. And I feel like it would be really cool to do like an epigraph as like it's from the text of the I like when those get used, right? Like, oh, it's from the book of whatever. So yeah, those are fun. I think they're fun. But yeah, I'm not opposed. And I also think if I have poems and lore epigraphs. Yeah. Like I think those are so important and so cool to add. It's like just like a sprinkle on top of everything. You're like, here's some more lore. It doesn't necessarily need to be included. It's not like giving away anything, but here's some more fun pieces. So yeah.
Yeah, I like, sorry, my phone volume went up for some reason. So sorry if there was an echo there. Yeah, I like the Book of Witnesses idea. Like when it's religious texts, I don't know why those are like my favorites. Dragon Age, it's a video game, but it does that like in the beginning before you even see anything, you're greeted with like religious verses from their Bible. Cool. And it's really cool. That's it sick. Just kind of sets the tone, and it's I don't know, it really fleshes out the faiths in that world. So yeah, I love the, like Megan said, I like the poems, and I also really enjoy the religious text ones as well.
Yeah. Adds a little.
All right. So to close out our topics for this episode, I tried really hard to pick something that we might disagree on. Okay.
Okay.
I tried really hard because I know last week we were joking about we're always in the same camp now. Which is fine. But I like to try once in a while to throw something in there that we might disagree on a little bit. So,
okay.
If we don't, I'm going to have to spend a little more time searching for something else. but
okay. Now I saw a little bit ahead, but I didn't read all of it. So I'll let you
all right. Know. Well, the topic is fan fiction. I wanted to get your thoughts on it as a reader and a writer, like always. Yeah. One, do you read fan fiction? Two, do you write fan fiction, or have you ever written, or would you ever write fan fiction? And when it comes to fan fiction, are there any ethical or like legal considerations that come into play that affect whether or not you will read or write? Like, what are your overall thoughts on just fan fiction as a whole?
Yeah, so I love fan fiction. I'm a huge, I go through phases, I will say, but yes, fan fiction has always been a part of my reading experience from being really small and reading Harry Potter up until recently with other franchises. I think fan fiction is phenomenal. I think it is a way for people to create a community within a community. And anytime I've read fan fiction, it's just genuinely always been good. And just like we were talking about earlier about being tired of franchises, I think fan fiction is unique in that aspect, in where every story is almost completely different from the original source material. So yes, huge fan. I have written, yes, fan fiction in my life. I actually stopped writing one recently just because I couldn't do all these projects and keep up with everything else. I find fan fiction, as funny as it can be sometimes, to be a really good exercise in just writing and warming up, especially if you have a story or characters you really like. There's a lot of debate about fan fiction. I think one of the biggest that I have been involved in is, well, there are a couple, and I might get some disagreements on this one, and that's totally okay. I do not think fan fiction, the whole concept of fan fiction, this is like going back to, oh my god, like Star Trek in the 70s, has never been used to make money. So any time money is exchanged in the realm of fan fiction, that's a big, in my opinion, red X, no way. Bookbinding, fan fiction tends to come into that.
Mm-hmm.
If you bookbind fan fiction yourself for your own library, that's one thing. And I think that is so cool and also such a great craft exercise and skill to learn. So if fan fiction is how you learn how to do that, great. The minute you do it to sell, I think that's awful because this person has written something for free because they love the content and they love the characters and the universe that it's in. So why are you doing that? They're not getting any royalties, so why should you be making money? That goes off into the realm also of people have written fan fiction and then gone on to make their own novel and book series based off of the fan fiction they write. And I don't disagree with that. I think, you know, you created a whole new plot with just these characters, so that now you can just change the character names and you've got a cool book. I think, though, recently with certain things that in certain fan fictions in general, I won't name any, but the question is like, this person deserves the money that they got from making, like, it's the most popular fan fiction to ever fan fiction, and now they're making it into a novel, so good for them. But I worry that sets a precedent for some people in the fan fiction world to like write content as a way to think that they're going to get a book deal. And I think that puts a lot of pressure on fan fiction writers.
Yeah.
So that's my long rant about how much I love fanfiction and why there are certain issues with people who consume fanfiction, not fanfiction writers in general. But like Cassandra Clare, I don't know if you read in any of her books. Her story is crazy. She's very famous in the fantasy. She wrote fan fiction about like Ron and Ginny from Harry Potter as like a incestuous thing.
Oh, and okay.
Ended up making it into like one of her most successful book series. So it can be weird, it can be strange, but anyway, love fan fiction. Shout out to all my fan fiction writers.
What are
your thoughts on fan fiction? Do you disagree?
Not with everything, no. With a few things. Okay. But I'll start with what I agree with. So I definitely agree with, and it's just, to me, it's just completely black and white. Like you cannot sell fan fiction. That's just, it's just blatant copyright infringement unless you have a deal with the publisher and the author. And at that point, it's not fan fiction anymore, really.
Right.
So yeah, if you're making money off of fan fiction, I think you're doing it for the wrong reasons, and you're ultimately capitalizing off of someone else's hard work, really, because they've done most of the heavy lifting for you. So totally agree in that. I just don't like that. Totally fine if you want to like bind something for yourself or whatnot. One of the biggest things that comes into play for me when it comes to whether I support like writing fan fiction for something at all is what are the author's wishes around it? Like,
interesting.
I know some authors are very outspoken supporters of people writing fan fiction of their work. And then I know some who are all like, who are very against it. And they're like, please do not post any fan fiction online. Now, obviously, that's just people ignore that. But I'm just, some authors make it very clear that they're uncomfortable with people writing stories in their world and then sharing them to like a wide audience. And so generally speaking, if I were, I haven't written fan fiction before. If I were to write it, one, the author's wishes would be very important to me. So if like the author has come out and said, hey, I get that you really like this world that I've built, but I just would appreciate if you guys don't write stories in my world. Now, I think some people misconstrue that as kind of like an attack, and it comes from a place of like concern around copyright, because there have been cases in the past where an author, one specifically, I think her name was Marion Zimmer Bradley or something along those lines. She was a big supporter of fan fiction writers of her work, to the point where she even published like anthologies with people that wrote fan fiction in her world. So at that point, it kind of became like canon, I suppose. But then doing that led to some legal issues when she wanted to publish a sequel novel, and ultimately she wasn't able to do that. And so that's someone who's kind of cited sometimes by these authors who do have concerns about people writing fan fiction. So I'm not totally for or against, like, you know, I'm not totally against all fan fiction or anything like that, but I personally just could not bring myself to either really read or write if the author has expressly said, please don't do that. And that's like George R. R. Martin is very outspoken about, like, if you want to write in my world, send me money first. Like he's very outspoken about that. Like, unless we have a licensing deal, I don't want to see stories from other people in my world. And some of the things he's
crazy,
like,
to me.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that's kind of, I'm kind of in a similar camp, not like totally against it, but I think the author's wishes should be respected. And to that extent, like, I don't usually read it if the author isn't, you know, supportive of it. There's also a lot of authors who just don't comment on it. And so that kind of gives me like a gray area of like, well, I don't know if the author likes this or not. But also when it comes to writing, I'm just more of a fan of creating my own stuff, my own worlds, my own characters. I like to do like imaginary scenarios for things like A Song of Ice and Fire and whatnot, but I don't really write them. Ultimately, I'll usually try to use those ideas to feed into an original world and cast of characters. But I do think that, like, if you are in a world that, you know, the author is supportive of it and everything like that, I think it can be a good writing exercise, especially for younger writers. I know, like, my younger sister loves writing. I think she does Harry Potter fan fiction as well. And she likes all of these worlds that she's engaged in. It gives her something to write and to practice her, you know, everything she learns about writing.
Yeah.
So I think there's definitely good that can come from it. And I think it also has potential, like anything, to cause harm to the author. But yeah, sorry, that is kind of a long winded
rant. That's okay. I guess we do disagree a little bit on this, which is fun. I do, if an author has expressly said, please don't write fan fiction about this, you know, I always want to respect someone's wishes. I feel like if it comes down to send me money and royalties first, it's also like, well, that's 99.9% of the time fan fiction doesn't, like, no money is exchanged for that, right? So when that's the kind of excuse for some authors, I'm kind of like, well, okay, that doesn't really count though, because almost all the time these stories include the characters in the world, but they are very different, right? And so it is an exercise in creativity. And, it, you know, when they say that about fan fiction, I'm like, okay, well, then you don't like people creating fan art either around your characters. Does that also count because they are interpreting your characters and making art from that? Are we going to say no to that as well? I think that's when it gets sticky.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you try and tamper down or limit people's creativity because they enjoy your work so much, it can get, it can be not so great. If the issues are like, oh, I've worked with fan fiction authors before and I've been spurned, totally understand that. Like,
yeah,
you know, but there have also been a lot of accusations for a lot of authors that they read people's fan fiction and then use their fan fiction to then write their books too. And you're like, okay, well, there's like tons of different gray areas and strangeness around this. I think the crux of the reason why fan fiction exists is because of the love of the universe and the characters, while also, you know, in certain characters' senses, like J.R.R. Martin, like, they either fade to black or, like, we don't see them for a while, and so people like to imagine what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, in the case of, like, the old Star Trek stuff, like, the homosexuality component of it was never really touched on very much, and so it was, like, a way for people to expound upon that in a way that they were like, oh, I feel like I'm connected to this, and what if Spock, you know. Anyway, so I get the author's wishes. I just don't think I necessarily fully agree as to why, unless you give me a good reason as an author, you put your work out into the world, right? And so to ask for no variation on that seems a little self-centered and selfish to me personally. If someone were like, can I write fan fiction about your work, I'd be like, oh my god, I'm honored. That's crazy. I know some authors, and I totally respect this, like, hey, all of my characters are underage, please don't write them in, like, heavily sexually explicit scenes.
Yeah.
That I understand. Like, 100% support that. Like, get it. These are, like, children.
Mm-hmm.
But in most regards, almost all the ones that I read, they're much older. So, you know, you kind of circumnavigate that. Yeah. It's an interesting topic. So you would not want anyone to write fan fiction about your novel?
I'm gonna say I don't have an answer for that yet.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair.
When it comes out, I'll try to have a more solid answer.
Yeah.
I will say I wouldn't be offended if there was fan fiction. Like, I understand that pretty much all the time it's coming from, like, a deep love of the work. So it's like,
yeah,
a real, I lost the word I was going for. It's an expression of, like, the appreciation of whatever work you're writing fan fiction of. And so ultimately, unless there was, like, obvious ill intent, like trying to sell it, I don't think I'd be, like, extremely opposed to it. But there are those caveats of, like, okay, but are you making money off of it, because that's just a hard red line, and things like that. But I also like some of the stories where people have been able to adapt their fan fiction into like an original work, like some of the ones you mentioned. I think if you do that and you take out all the references to an existing IP and you really make it something original and unique, I think that's a totally valid way to start a story, and kind of a unique way to turn it into your own thing. So Yeah. I don't want it to sound like I'm completely anti-fan fiction or anything. I think I'm a little less open to it than some people are. I'm a little more cautious, I would say.
Makes sense.
When I go into it. And then also this is just a personal preference. A lot of times I don't like spending much time with things that aren't canon. The only exception I'll make to that is like sometimes if there's like an adaptation. So like an adaptation, Game of Thrones, for example, obviously the show isn't canon to the books, but it's the only adaptation. So I'm going to watch it.
Right.
So things like that. But it's just this, and I will fully accept that it's just how my brain works is just, it's a weird thing that I can't get past, like feeling like it's meaningless. And I know it's not. I'm just, it's one of those weird mental blocks that I have where it's weird. Cause I mean, I don't like it. I don't like that my brain works like that. I really try to get past it sometimes, but yeah. Yeah, it's weird. Like if something isn't canon, it's really hard for me to spend time with it. I don't know why.
Interesting. Huh. Because I want to acknowledge that is also totally okay. I know people who are like, I tried to get into it and I just can't for various reasons. But, you know, if you love something so much and you take a lot of, like, it matters to you, right? And so when they divert from the canon, you're like, no, that's not right, though. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Versus me, I'm like, take me out of the canon completely. Like, totally don't care. Yeah. It's like, it's mostly, in my opinion, mostly to do with the characters. I enjoy a few characters in a few different fantasy universes enough that I want to see more of them where, and most of these characters are side characters. They're not even like the main characters. So for side characters, I think that's where like a lot of people find enjoyment in fan fiction is that you get to write their stories when we didn't really see much of them, or you know, oh yeah, we just like, or their lives just kind of ended because the main characters continue, whatever. So I think it's a way for people to connect with characters that they find to be, you know, more important. But yeah, I also totally get it, the canon aspect of it. It's like when you've got so many Star Wars novels, it's right. Like you don't have to divert from canon very much,
right?
You know, you don't have to come up with stuff.
Well, I think we finally found something that we have slightly different opinions on. That's cool.
Yeah, I like it.
It's nice to hear in a different perspective sometimes. So
I agree.
Always happy to explore those. I just think we're so aligned in so many ways that it's hard to find them.
Yeah,
so.
It's really hard. I think I've mentioned it before too that I've like written fan fiction before, so I'm like not surprised that this eventually came up. But,
that's partially why I brought it up, because I was like, I'm pretty sure she's mentioned it before, so I wanted to.
Yeah.
Well, that's maybe one of our first slightly varying opinions on something.
Yeah. I feel like the first one was G.R. Martin, and then this one is fantasy, and then he also came up in this, so we can just continue our disagreements on G.R. Martin.
For sure. It's weird because I don't like when I relate to George R.R. Martin a lot. I feel like sometimes it seems, I want it to be clear that he's my favorite author because I relate to him so much, not the other way around. Not like I'm echoing him because he's my favorite author, if that makes sense.
No,
right?
I totally get it. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. No, I hear you. I'm very much aware that you are like this, and okay. Not because like you want to be G.R.R. Martin, but yeah, totally.
Oh, Nicole, I'm sorry. We'll send you a reminder next Tuesday or something.
Yes.
But so I was wondering where you were. I was like, she must be busy. But yeah, you can listen on Spotify, on YouTube soon, anywhere.
It happens.
We'll forgive you.
Yeah. just this once, though. Only this once.
One pass. All right. Well, those are all our topics for the week. We're going to move into our weekly resources. I think we flipped roles this week.
We did.
It looks like you don't have a resource, but if you came up with one, I don't want to take that away from you. So.
I did not. It's not that I didn't forget. I just couldn't find one that we hadn't already kind of like touched
the
on
same.
Before. So I think maybe going forward, we'll have to switch up this section and maybe add something.
For sure. Yeah. We'll definitely talk about like expanding it in some way, or maybe limiting it to like one resource. We don't have to come up with two every week, because I feel we do sometimes just like run out of resources. Like we've listed so many. Yeah. It's Megan says, send me a reminder too if it's not about it. For sure. I'll make a note to send you both live reminders. And if they ever get annoying, please let me know.
Yeah. Also on the Instagram, I think I posted on the Instagram. So if you don't follow us, I'll post every Tuesday when we're going to go live. So
that's right.
You can get that as well.
Well, I do have a weekly writing resource. I don't think I've shared this one before. Apologies if I have, but if I did, it was like the very first or second episode. So you may not have even seen it. So this one is called World Anvil. It is a website where you can host like wikis and maps and family trees and all these things that are part of your world. It's a big world building tool.
Nice.
If you've ever wanted to have like your own Wikipedia for your world, this is probably the best place to do it, because you can do like the linked articles that when you reference something, you can have, if you're a dungeon master, you're into D&D, you can do things like character sheets and stuff like that. Like, this is also useful for game masters, game devs, creatives of all types, but they do also have some writing tools for like manuscript editing and writing and drafting and all those things. So, yeah, it's a really cool tool, and they have tiers all the way from, I think, $450 to all the way up to like $25 a month for like the professional plan or whatever. But you can also jump in and try all the features, or not all of them, but most of them for free, to see if it's something for you. But yeah, it's a really cool tool. I like the ability to have like your own Wikipedia. It's awesome.
Yeah, that's sick. Well, very cool resource. I like that.
Yeah,
I think I'm going to, one, an idea for me is I'm going to clip all of our resources together, because we have some pretty good ones.
Yeah, I think we've suggested that to each other before. We definitely have to pull them together and put them up for people just to go and find them. And then also so we don't repeat them.
But. Right. So much to do. But very cool. I like that research. I will probably take a look at it, because world building.
Yeah, it's so fun. My favorite way to make progress but also like not get any writing done is just do more world building. Yeah,
just mess around.
Well, I think that covers all of our topics for the week. I think Nicole and Megan are still with us, so if you guys have any questions, any topic suggestions, any feedback, anything at all, now is the time to share before we sign off.
We did it, Brandon. We had another episode.
Yeah, 14 episodes. This is two pretty in crazy. The new setup, so it's nice. Yeah,
pretty good. I like it.
See you, Megan. Thanks for joining.
Bye, Megan. Thanks for all the likes. Your thumbs must hurt after all of that clicking.
Yeah, the likes are appreciated.
Yes.
Well, we love you too, Nicole.
Love you too, Nicole. Thanks for always watching.
Well.
All right, Brandon. Guess that's it.
Yep, that's everything. So I don't have any closing thoughts, but if you have any.
Me neither.
Okay.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for co-hosting, as always. And we will see you guys maybe next week.
Yes, I think we'll let you know.
We'll let you know. All right.
Okay, bye, y'all.
Bye, everybody.